Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the roiling political turmoil in the country over race relations and gun control following the shooting of African-American men in Louisiana, then Minnesota, then the payback massacre of police officers in Dallas by an African-American sniper who shot dead five policemen and wounded seven others in the midst of a peaceful demonstration against police violence. Garrett Duncan, a professor of African American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis, joins us to discuss the sudden shift from public sympathy for victims of police violence to public sympathy for the police as victims of violence, as well as the role of guns in our society since Philander Castile in Minnesota was apparently killed because of his mere possession of a gun, which flies in the face of the NRA's claim that guns prevent violence as opposed to attracting it. Then we will speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Linda Greenhouse, who covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for nearly 30 years and currently teaches at Yale Law School. We'll discuss the recent decisions from an evenly divided Supreme Court that is unable to seat a replacement for the late Justice Antonin Scalia, Judge Merrick Garland, who President Obama has nominated because the Republican Majority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, wants to wait for the results of the next election to see if his candidate, Donald Trump, who McConnell has not endorsed, will win and thus be able to pick a right-wing replacement. We will also discuss Linda Greenhouse's latest book just out, The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. Then finally, we'll examine the travails of Roger Ailes, the Republican political power broker and head of Fox News, who is now facing sexual harassment charges from a former Fox anchor, Gretchen Carlson, with a number of other women coming forward to buttress her claims. Dr. Kerwin Swint, a professor of politics at Kennesaw University and author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes, and his latest, The King Whisperer, Power Behind the Throne from Rasputin to Rove, joins us. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating this coming Tuesday, July the 12th at 7:30 p.m. with Linda Greenhouse, who's a former New York Times journalist and a contributing columnist to the New York Times, as well as a lecturer at Yale Law School. We'll be talking about the gridlock in the Supreme Court, and we'll be examining the decisions as well as talking about her new book, The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. So join me on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, July the 12th at 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood for Justice in the Balance, free and open to the public. And joining us now is Garrett Duncan, who is a professor of education and African and African-American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
Thank you for having me.
And Garrett, there's an awful lot. I mean, the whole country seems to be sort of roiling at the moment. And so many people I've run into in the last few days have sort of questioned sort of rhetorically, has the country gone mad? So you have this roiling stew of race relations and gun control. And it seems that we've been whipsawed from one day feeling sympathetic towards African-American men who have been killed by the police in ways that appear on camera to be absolutely insupportable and absolutely disgraceful. And then the next day, an even worse and more heinous crime takes place in Dallas. So do you see a way out of this mess?
Well, you know, this is happens to be a part of our history. We wax and wane and ebb and flow along these lines, especially since emancipation. So I don't know if there will be a way out of it completely, but I'm hopeful. I see things that are substantive that are occurring, conversations, especially the youth-led Black Lives Movement or Black Lives Matter movement, will present great possibilities in the people who are supporting them. So I will see a lessening, but at the same time, I can imagine, just as in what happened with Rodney King and Latasha Harlan back in the 1990s, the social movements back in the 1960s, if we don't really take things considerably and engage in an honest and task-based discussion we can imagine seeing something like this happening in the future.
But in terms of Black Lives Matter, President Obama has, in condemning the violence against the police, also mentioned excessive and nasty rhetoric coming from Black Lives Matter, not from the entire organizations. It's hard to know who actually speaks on behalf of Black Lives Matter. But the president did, he, just to quote him accurately, "Now, in a movement like Black Lives Matter, there will always be folks who say things that are stupid or imprudent or overgeneralized or harsh." So do you think that the president is right in his criticism of Black Lives Matter?
I think his statement was very unfortunate. And I say this because when we see the same type of violence exacted against black communities by those who are paid by us to protect and serve us, we don't condemn the entire police, or he hasn't condemned the entire police organization. And so I think he should be a little bit more selective. I see it as a political gesture. I don't say this as someone who would condemn the president, but I say it on good faith, that I saw that as a political gesture, and I think it's quite unfortunate. It doesn't contribute. I think it works against it.
Well, but surely the person who really works against it is the shooter in Dallas. I mean,
oh, absolutely. But to place him in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement and to associate him or his attitude. We didn't need the discourses from the Black Lives Matter movement for someone to be angry over the outrageous acts over the past that's been concentrated over the past couple of years. And so for almost conflating a social justice movement with a senseless act of violence is, I believe, is unfortunate. And I'm being very kind in my use of language here.
Sure. Well, of course, Garrett Duncan's a professor of African and African American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis, and we've spoken in the past, of course, when the Michael Brown shooting happened in your neighborhood in St. Louis, and I think we talked a few times about it, and it's frankly pretty depressing to think that we're back to ground zero again. In this case, although the footage of Philando Castile being shot has really gripped everybody's attention and brought the governor of the state of Minnesota to say this would not have happened had the victim been a white person. The one thing that struck me about that was that, as far as the attorney for the policeman who shot Philando Castile, he's claiming that it was the gun, the possession of a gun, and apparently he had a concealed carry permit. So to my mind, that is an example that flies in the face of everything the NRA tells us about how guns prevent violence. The more guns, the less violence. It's obvious in this case that his possession of a gun attracted violence, and one doesn't really know why he had a concealed carry permit. And in the case of the shooter in Dallas, he apparently was discharged from the military with some mental illness issues, and yet he was able to purchase a assault rifle. So, and indeed, many of the people demonstrating with the Black Lives Matter movement in Dallas at the time of the shooting, they were carrying assault weapons as well. And this added to the confusion when there were bullets flying and policemen being shot, people walking around with assault rifles complicate the situation. So I'm beginning to wonder whether the whole country's lost its mind over guns and why a minority of 5+ million people, members of the NRA, can hold this entire country hostage to their peculiar views about public safety.
Right. I'd like to step back for a second to a earlier remark you just made regarding back to ground zero. I don't know that we're back to ground zero, because those of us in these communities know that things have been going on. The difference is that the technologies, the social media technologies, have brought to surface and placed on our radar things that were neglected because of our corporate-based media. But, you know, guns have always been a part. I mean, we have the photographic history of guns being carried openly and throughout the United States, throughout our history. So, but there is, there seems to be an increase in violence, and I believe it has largely to do with fears, and often legitimate fears over our futures linked to our economic woes. You have folks who are concerned about the lives of their children, the safety of their homes, especially in certain communities that are not being served and protected. Folks will see themselves having to protect themselves or as a part of the economic trend associated with the drug trafficking, where you can't, you're not being hired for a legitimate job, and or a so-called legitimate job, and as a result, you have to take care of family members. The same thing happened in Louisiana, where you had a man selling his wares and doing it legitimately so and legally so. And so there's an economic dimension connected to the fears people have about their own futures and the futures of their children.
Well, in terms of Black Lives Matter, is there a focus on the so-called black-on-black violence? For example, just recently there was a weekend in Chicago where I believe over 50 people were killed. Now, of course, most violence in this country is white-on-white violence, so you certainly have to put that in that context. But I'm curious to know whether the Black Lives Matter movement also addresses the wholesale killing within these communities. And you mentioned the drug aspect, and I believe most of the killings in Chicago are over drug turf and between various gangs in the drug business. So address that, if you will.
I will, and I appreciate you bringing that to the fore, because there's a lot of rhetoric about that. What also is off the radar are how the very same communities that you've mentioned actually organize themselves to work with individuals to reduce the violence by providing different types of resources, activities, opportunities to have different futures. These are typically led by the mothers in these communities, faith-based organizations, and youth movements, but you rarely see these activities broadcast on the news, and it gives the impression to the larger masses who are unaware of these projects that have been going on for since forever that we don't care and that our only focus is on police perpetrated violence. Also, when we say black-on-black violence, and I'm glad you brought up the white-on-white violence, the black-on-black violence, so-called black-on-black violence, is a result of us, again, not being afforded or accorded the same services that are provided in other communities where you have violence, but people are being served and protected. And so the concern I have about this black-on-black violence is spoken of in terms of cultural and behavioral tendencies of not only black youth, but black people in general, and an indifference on the part of black folks. We have been thoroughly and actively engaged in reducing the violence in our communities, but it's not, there's a saying, if it doesn't bleed, it won't lead. And so it's there, and we know this.
Well, but isn't there a kind of self-reinforcing dynamic there? The problem with the police in many ways is that they're recruiting veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been in combat and who see the streets that they patrol as enemy territory. And then they move to the United States and they take that mindset with them because they do feel that it's not like that we have neighborhood policing. We have kind of an attitude that there's an occupied territory or you know, a war zone because of the very violence that you're talking about. So how do you reduce that dynamic? My sense is that, I don't know whether you saw, Garrett, the very moving testimony of a black policewoman who was deeply upset, and that's sort of gone viral. Is that a part of the way out? Can African-American police officers help in clearly healing this bridge?
I will not. Not only African American police officers, but a number of police officers. One of the things I think you're spot on. We speak of the militarization of policing nowadays. We see the different technologies, the tanks, the weaponry. But one of the things we have to consider the very origin of the police state occurred as a way to contain and sequester Black communities from post-emancipation. You had a policing force set up to prevent and to sequester Black or to protect white lives from perceived possible Black violence. So now, but the difference today is, and you know, this has gone on through on and out throughout our history. But the difference today is the militarization, which is an exacerbation of what's going on. But indeed, I think the greatest thing that can happen with respect the brave officer, the brave female officer, if others will follow her lead and will call out the foul activity of some of her colleagues. But there's also a culture within police departments, you know, snitches end up in ditches or at least outside of a job. There is a culture of silence and looking the other way with regard to the warrant behavior, the errant behaviors, I should say, of police officers. And we attributed this to gangs, you know, no snitching. But the same thing can be attributed to the culture of policing in our society.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I thank you for joining us. I wish it was under different circumstances, but I hope we can stay in touch.
Oh, you better believe it, and I appreciate you having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of African and African-American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the recent Supreme Court decisions with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Linda Greenhouse, who's covered the Supreme Court for 30 years for the New York Times.
New absence in a mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs, and the soul eased out of the slums, and the voice eased out of the drums, the sirens.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Linda Greenhouse, is a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize and other major journalism awards, who has covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for nearly 30 years. Since 2009, she has taught at Yale Law School and written a biweekly op-ed column on the court as a contributing writer for the New York Times. And her latest book, co-authored with Michael Gratz, is The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Linda Greenhouse.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And your book deals with the sort of interregnum, if you will, between the liberal Warren Court and the current Roberts, and I guess prior to that, conservative Rehnquist Court. So it's not really, as many historians have thought of, the Burger Court as a kind of passive interregnum. You see much more going on there between 1969 and 1986.
Oh, completely. Yes, I mean, the Burger Court in that crucial period, the Nixon administration segueing into the Reagan administration, has been really overlooked in history because it's been sort of written off as, well, transitional period, and even though, of course, Richard Nixon ran against the liberal Warren Court when he ran for president in 1968, none of the Warren Court decisions were actually overturned in the Berger Court years, and so that's kind of misled people into thinking, well, you know, just nothing much was going on. What we argue in the book is that, in fact, although the Warren Court decisions were left standing as a technical, formal matter, they were hollowed out from the inside. A bunch of termites had gotten in and ate away at them, especially the criminal procedure, the protections for criminal suspects and criminal defendants, and that's what we try to unpack in the book.
So let's start, though, with the definitions themselves, which I've always had trouble with. Invariably, they talk about the conservative versus liberal balance, whether it's 5-4 either way. And now, of course, with the absence of Justice Scalia, it's 4-4. But my sense is that the so-called liberals on this court bear little to no resemblance to the liberals like William O. Douglas in the Warren Court or Thurgood Marshall. So what's your definition of if you go through all of the justices, are there some liberals, mostly centrists, and pretty clear conservatives? That's the way I see it, at least.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, my definition of a capital L liberal is a justice like you mentioned William O. Douglas, I'd say Earl Warren also, William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall. Those people have been gone for a long time. People who saw the Constitution as an engine of social progress to be harnessed by the Supreme Court. There's nobody on the Supreme Court today who really fits that definition. Liberals have been playing defense for such a long time on the Supreme Court and elsewhere that they really are by a spectrum that would have applied a generation ago, centrists and moderates for sure.
So has the Supreme Court always been in step or always out of step with the political mood of the country, if that can be in any way divined accurately? For example, we've just seen in this recent primary election the surprising rise of the political left in this country that is galvanized around Bernie Sanders. So you have an extremely conservative court, but you may not entirely have a conservative country.
Well, there's certainly a relationship between the mood of the country and the Supreme Court. Now, exactly what that relationship is, which is the cart and which is the horse, is a really fascinating subject. And political scientists who've studied this for many years have not come to any kind of consensus. But there's certainly a dialectic that goes on. So the court inevitably responds to the public mood, which makes a lot of sense because new presidents come into office. Presidents have the ability to name people to the court. They name people to the court who fit the mood of that time, and then things change, and politics goes on, and life goes on, and all of a sudden the court's out of step, and maybe our politics arise around that to reflect and push back against that. You could say that maybe is part of the Sanders movement, that people had a feeling that the Supreme Court was out of step and that our politics was kind of out of joint, and they coalesced around Bernie Sanders. It's a back and forth, and so there's very often a lag time, or you might say the issues that led a particular president to make a particular choice for the Supreme Court 10, 20, 30 years later could be a completely different set of issues that nobody ever thought of at the time of the confirmation. So it's just a fascinating and very complicated subject.
Well, but it does seem, though, that the Supreme Court's decision, this particular court, Roberts Court's decision in Citizens United, of course, has resonated extraordinarily and is very much shaping this current election. And in terms of decisions, of course, going back to the Berger Court, you can't help noticing the groundwork for this tectonic shift in the way elections are financed. Because, in other words, this kind of validates your thesis, Linda Green, as Buckley v. Vallejo is clearly the underpinning, is it not,
of Citizens United?
Well, we actually take it back to a case that few people remember called Bellotti against First National Bank of Boston, which was a Burger Court decision that for the first time said that corporations have a First Amendment right to speak, to spend money in politics. And, of course, that sort of set the ball in motion that led to Citizens United. It did not inevitably lead to Citizens United. Obviously, Citizens United was a 5-4 decision, so four justices thought that that was not an inevitable result, and we don't argue that. But to the extent that when Citizens United came down in January of 2010, and people were shocked at the notion that the First Amendment gave corporations the right to spend money in politics, that idea itself was not a new idea. That's anchored back in the Berger years.
Well, I must say, when Justice Scalia died, there was very little footage of him. He didn't seem to grant a lot of interviews, at least on television. And the only interview that I saw was with a celebrity journalist on CNN, this British journalist who does sort of tabloid-type stuff. And he did ask Scalia about that the decision. And Scalia said, well, money is speech. There's no way to get around it. And, of course, I wish the interviewer would have said, does that mean the more money you have, the more speech you have? I mean, how did that concept get cemented in and essentially go unquestioned?
Well, I mean, it hasn't gone unquestioned.
I guess
that,
not.
For instance, Justice John Paul Stevens believed that that was really the wrong way to look at it. I think as a matter of common sense, though, of course, money enables speech. And so the question would be, and the question that the Supreme Court confronted in another Burger Court decision, Buckley against Valeo, which you mentioned, is there a role for equality of opportunity to speak in our constitutional system, so that it won't necessarily be the case that the more money you have, the more you can speak. And the court in Buckley against Valeo, and this has been ratified in several Roberts Court decisions subsequently, said there is no role in the constitutional system for equalizing that set of opportunities. So that actually it is the case that the more money you have, the louder you can speak and the more influence you can have in our politics.
So it does seem now with this hung jury at the Supreme Court, or the potential, and we've had some odd rulings as a result of that, that the dysfunction and gridlock in the legislative branch has sort of migrated to the judicial branch, but the main apologist for it, of course, is the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who's basically argued, in fact, I think within hours of Scalia's death, he was out saying, we're not going to have hearings, I'm not going to confirm anybody, and we're going to let the people decide in the next election. If the people decide that Donald Trump is the next president of the United States, which is presumably what Mitch McConnell wants, since he's a Republican, what I find paradoxical is that Mitch McConnell himself hasn't even endorsed Donald Trump and has gone on the record saying he has real problems with him. So is anybody really questioning the is this just naked partisanship? Because that's a pretty thin excuse, don't you think?
Oh, I mean, when McConnell came out with that announcement, as you said, within hours of Justice Scalia's death, it was jaw-dropping. It was just astonishing. There's no precedent for it, actually. I mean, some Republicans say, well, this is normal behavior in an election year. No, that's not true. It's never been the case that a president, almost a year before a national election, nominates somebody to a Supreme Court vacancy who doesn't even get a hearing. And this is announced in advance of any nomination being made. It's really astonishing. And, of course, Mitch McConnell back in February had no particular reason to assume, because the country certainly didn't assume that Donald Trump would be the presumptive Republican nominee by the time of the summer solstice. So it's just been an amazing series of events.
But he hasn't changed his mind, has he, McConnell?
No. He's gotten more dug in than ever. I mean, there were initially a few Republican senators in purple states who had reason to think that this hardline stance would not serve them well in their reelection. But what happened was, if they were seeming a little bit squishy, there were people in their state who said, we're going to run a hard right primary against you, incumbent senator. And that forced people to jump back into line. And what it seemed to be, you know, maybe a somewhat dynamic process going on back in the mid-spring, just froze into place. And there's been really no discussion about it ever since.
So returning to your new book with Michael Gratz, Linda Greenhouse, The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right, in terms of breaking down the activities of the Burger Court, you have the categories of crime, race, social transformation, business, and the presidency. One of the things that's always struck me about these confirmation hearings, where they often, you know, sort of go circle the wagons around the issue of abortion and other social issues, but I've never, ever heard anybody question potential justices on whether or not they're corporatists or not. Is that an omission that you've recognized?
No, not actually. I'm not sure how that question would be framed.
Well, if you look at the law, you know, in broad terms, it seems to me that there's a there are sort of public interest lawyers and there are corporate lawyers and I guess they're criminal lawyers, etc. But if you have the preponderance of justices on the Supreme Court coming out of corporate law, isn't that in itself something to be flagged?
Well, of course, that hasn't actually been the case,
I guess. No, it hasn't.
I mean, the one who came out of corporate law was, in fact, in the Burger years, the most outspoken champion of the role of the corporation, and that was Justice Lewis Powell, who had never been a judge before. He was a lawyer in private practice. He was the head partner of a big corporate law firm in the Southeast. And he played a very important role in the Burger years. He was kind of the swing justice, as Justice Kennedy is today. He held the balance of power as the court got more divided. And he was a big believer in enhancing the role of corporations in American life and within the constitutional system. But I can't think of any other justices.
Right. Well, the reason I bring it up is that what we've discussed so far indicates, you know, a kind of corporatist bias, particularly in terms of speech, as you mentioned with the Boston decision before Buckley v. Vallejo and now Citizens United, which has clearly benefited the corporations. I mean, they say it's, you know, they make a nod to money from unions, but we know that unions, there's no parity between the corporate power and union power in the political sphere. So
right.
I'm just curious to know whether that is something that, because I've never found these hearings to be particularly satisfactory. And one of the things that's extraordinary about them is the deals that appear to be made. Recently, somebody told me that Clinton made some deals to get people on the court without them being filibustered. But the deal was that they wouldn't be young people, like the conservatives have put young justices on. Is there a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on that we don't see in these public hearings, notwithstanding that extraordinary movie that HBO just put out recently about Justice Thomas?
What you just said about Bill Clinton, I never heard that, and I don't believe it, actually.
Right.
I don't know where that comes from.
No. Well, I do all these interviews all the time. I wish I remembered who it was, but it was relatively recently. I'll have to look it up. But so the processes themselves, in terms of what we see, do you see them as being deficient? It seems more like theater than substance.
Oh, totally. In fact, it's very funny because when Elena Kagan was a law professor, she wrote an article that was very critical of the confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominees, saying it was just, you know, it had devolved, and I forget exactly the word she used, but just kind of a meaningless circus. And, of course, when she herself became the nominee, She was really no more forthcoming than the nominees that she had criticized for not actually saying anything substantive. So, you know, people just kind of get caught up in this. And, you know, the standard for a nominee, if they're asked a question about some hypothetical case, they'll say, well, I can't answer that because it might come before the court. And, of course, if they're asked a non-hypothetical question about a specific case, they say, well, I can't answer that because that's a Supreme Court case, you know. So that we're left with this kind of shadow play. And it's really more important, I think, to know who the person is, what their professional life has been, what their values are, how those values have been manifested in their public service and so on, than any particular set of questions and answers in this shadow play on television of a confirmation hearing.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I've also heard about a phenomenon described as Supreme Court shopping. And it does seem that, for example, Citizens United, which you talked about, seemed to come out of nowhere. And the fellow that put it forth was himself a fairly troubled figure. He was fired by the Republican House for manipulating the prison tapes of Clinton's first effort at Attorney General, Webb Hubble, who, needless to say, didn't make it. But there was also, I think, in the Heller case, there was a surprise that it seemed to be conveniently landing on the lap. So is there a process there? Because there have been some of these cases seem to happen very quickly, and they seem to happen rather conveniently. And my assumption has always been that they have to work their way through the judicial process, and that's the purpose of the Supreme Court, rather than suddenly, you know, out of like lightning striking, and suddenly they're right there on the lap of the justices.
Citizens United is an interesting story, and on the one hand, it seemed to come out of nowhere. On the other hand, as we said earlier, it had doctrinally, it had roots in early cases. But what happened in Citizens United is that the question presented to the court was really a very narrow one. It was, does this particular film that was an attack on Hillary Clinton meet the definition of the kind of political advertisement that cannot be broadcast within a certain amount of time before the election under the McCain-Feingold law? That was a very narrow question. This film, yes. This film, no. What the court did was get hold of this and use it as a vehicle basically to take down the entire campaign finance regulatory system, not the entire system, but a big chunk of it, which became the Citizens United case. The court went beyond the question that actually had been presented to it and ordered the case re-argued with the broader question. So that is certainly an example of, you know, what in the old days might have been called judicial activism.
So are there sort of small groups of activists, though, that sort of circle the Supreme Court, if you will, for want of a better description, who are specialized in getting their cases heard? Is that something that happens?
Well, I mean, you say activists circling the court. This came from within the court.
Right.
The court itself generated the question that they then answered in Citizens United. Well, of course, there's social movements on the right and the left, and that's part of the way our system works. And, you know, I don't think we should have a particular, you know, fear and loathing of that. But, you know, there's an active Supreme Court bar that's always on the lookout for cases that they think will appeal to the court. The court has almost total discretion over what cases it chooses to hear. So, you know, the court has a lot to do with setting the country's legal agenda. But on the other hand, the court can only work with the cases that people bring to it. They can't just cobble cases out of thin air. So it's a kind of a
right.
Interesting dynamic there.
Well, let's just close then on one of the stories that I've heard, which seems to be an extraordinarily ironic story, and that is that Sandra Day O'Connor, her husband had Alzheimer's, and she wanted to spend more time with him. And she went to the Chief Justice Rehnquist and said, I understand you want to retire, but I want to retire, so who should retire first? And he said, well, why don't you go ahead and retire? And then shortly thereafter, of course, Rehnquist himself got ill. And then I believe by the time that Sandra Day O'Connor retired, her husband was in pretty bad shape, and that she regrets retiring.
What I've written, the facts of the matter are, Chief Justice Rehnquist was very sick. He had a very aggressive form of thyroid cancer that had been diagnosed about 9 months earlier. And as you said, John O'Connor was failing. Justice O'Connor went to the Chief Justice beginning of the summer of 2005 and said, Bill, I'm thinking that I should leave the court, but if you're about to retire, I don't think there should be two vacancies, and so I'll wait. And he said to her, my doctor tells me I have another good year, so I'm going to stay. You know, he was... It's not a human way. He was in denial. He was 80 years old. He didn't want to think he was terminally ill. So she then announced her retirement over the July 4th weekend in the summer of 2005. And over the Labor Day weekend that summer, Chief Justice Rehnquist died. So, it's a very human story. And we were left with the two vacancies, and that brought us Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Sam Alito. And that was the beginning of the Roberts Court.
And I believe Sandra Day O'Connor is not thrilled with her replacement, Alito.
Probably not. She's been discreet, but right. I think, she's seen things that she stood for dismantled, and I think I'm sure she's not happy about it.
Well, I thank you so much, and it's when you talk about the human side of it, that's what's so valuable about your book and your work, and I appreciate it, Linda Greenhouse.
I look forward to talking with you further.
Well, indeed, and I should mention that we are going to be—you'll be joining us at the UCLA Hammer Forum on this coming Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. In Westwood, and I look forward to that conversation too.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Linda Greenhouse, who's a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize and other major journalism awards, who has covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for nearly 30 years. And since 2009, she has taught at Yale Law School and written a biweekly op-ed column on the court as a contributing writer for the New York Times. And her latest book, co-authored with Michael Gratz, is The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right.
We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the travails of Roger Ailes, the Republican political power broker and head of Fox News, who's now facing sexual harassment charges from a former Fox anchor, Gretchen Carlson. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Kerwin Swint, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes, and his latest book is The King Whisperer, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kerwin Swint.
Thank you very much, Ethan. Ian, I'm sorry.
And it seems that Roger Ailes, the political power broker and kingmaker who runs Fox News, is in a bit of trouble, I would say. The popular Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson has filed sexual harassment charges against him. And six other women have come forward to buttress her claims. So what's your sense of one, these charges, and two,
whether they are going to affect the career of the Roger Ailes.
Well, I have to say it was somewhat surprising that these kinds of charges were leveled against Roger Ailes. In my research, I didn't find anything of a sexual nature or any kind of harassment issue like that. What I did find, though, was a man, Roger Ailes, who is used to getting his way. He's used to getting what he wants. He operates somewhat like a politician or a political figure, a political consultant, which obviously he used to be. In that he believes that he is above the fray, that he can do whatever he wants to, and that's okay. So in that light, it's not terribly shocking that allegations of this kind would surface. It's just rather surprising in that it seemed to come out of nowhere.
Well, he is, of course, a man that apparently sort of loves power or sees himself as a powerful figure, which he clearly is, and particularly in Republican circles. He's very much a kingmaker, and he's created a what some people have referred to as the Pravda of the Republican Party. There's no question that Fox News is an adjunct to the Republican Party. But my understanding is that to some extent this appears to have gone to his head, because he has more security around him than most people, except probably the President of the United States. He travels in these huge convoys with bodyguards, etc. Is that your understanding?
Well, I think so. That's my understanding. And, you know, he treats people like he is a kingmaker, like he is, you know, an old-time movie producer from the 40s. You know, he can just, you know, have people come to him at his whimsy. And, you know, that may be catching up to him. If there are a lot of reports like this that do surface and they're corroborated, then he could be, of course, in a great deal of trouble. It's interesting, though, because he's, I believe, 76 years old. And there is some intrigue behind the scenes at News Corporation with Rupert Murdoch's two sons, Lachlan and James Murdoch. Word is, and reporting has been, that they would like to find a successor to Roger Ailes in a not-too-distant future. And, you know, if this gets really sticky for him, that could hasten that kind of movement at News Corp.
Well, apparently it was one of the sons that led to the divorce of Rupert Murdoch from Wendy Deng, who apparently was in one of Rupert Murdoch's country estates for the weekend, and with Tony Blair visiting, and they got up to all kinds of sexual activity that the help reported to the son, who then in turn reported to the father, and he promptly divorced Wendy Deng. So perhaps
yeah, I've read that.
Yes, perhaps the boys are also going to play a role here. That's what you've suggested. And my understanding is that they do have a somewhat different vision for Fox. They want to bring it, you know, up to in line with a younger generation and a more social media savvy generation. Is that what you've heard?
That's exactly right. And they also see Roger Ailes as, you know, part of the past, and they want to move into the future. I think there's also some interest in making Fox News a little less partisan. And it already has, over the last couple of years, with Megyn Kelly in particular, become not middle of the road or neutral, but less overtly partisan Republican than they have been in the past. And I think there's some interest in maybe the younger Murdoch brothers of furthering that and making it a more legitimate sort of news source for more people.
So what is the understanding then of these six women who've come forth? Do you have any idea of whether they're going to be joining the suit? I mean, we had a similar phenomenon with Bill Cosby, where a couple of women came forth, and then the sort of floodgates opened. What role do they play, do you think, these extra women?
Well, I mean, the obvious parallel is the Bill Cosby situation, but it's probably premature to jump to that sort of storyline, because we don't know yet how credible these witnesses are. We don't really know yet how credible Gretchen Carlson's claims are, even though she puts forth a strong case and has a lawsuit in the works. But it's going to come down to corroboration, I think. I mean, are these What I've read so far is there are people who have said he said things to them in the past, that he said things that could be considered sexual harassment, but it was never brought out until now. So it's going to depend on how strong that kind of evidence is. If it is strong and if it is credible, then you know, Ailes could be in quite a bit of trouble in his career.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Kerwin Swint, who is an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns and elections and mass media. And he's the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperer, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. So it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, to think how the sexual harassment cases have ended up having some pretty powerful effects and creating a lot of attention. I mean, Julian Assange has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for God knows how long because he has a sexual harassment charge hanging over him. And now Roger Ailes is in the crosshairs as well. How did it become such a kind of explosive charge?
Well, I mean, as you say, sexual harassment charges can create a lot of havoc for someone's personal life, their career. These are particularly relevant because of the high-profile person Roger Ailes is and the role that Fox News plays and has played over the last 10 to 15 years in our political and media system. He's a rock star. He's a big player. And so like any big corporate player, a political player, there's going to be tons of attention around something like this. And Gretchen Carlson knows that very well. That's you know, part of why she did it. It's going to get attention. It's going to get a lot of play. You know, so yeah, it's an interesting sort of thing to happen to someone this late in Roger Ailes' career. And some of the statements from some of the ones backing these charges up is that, well, he's been doing this for years. He has sort of this expectation of you know, people under him. But at the same time, you have to say there are some others who have come out in Roger Ailes' defense. Maria Bartiromo, who came over from CNBC to Fox News Business. Others at Fox News, women who have known Roger Ailes for years. And so, you know, you've got people on both sides, some castigating him, some defending him.
Well, the quote that came out of the court filings from Gretchen Carlson's attorney indicate that she claims that he basically said to her that had we had a sexual relationship a long time ago, you wouldn't have any problems. And the problems that she had was that he'd moved her from the Fox and Friends gathering of there's three of them. It's a popular show, but she was complaining apparently to her bosses about the way she's being treated by Steve Doocy on that show, and nothing happened. And then she got switched to her own show, and then I guess what happened with Ailes was he just let her contract expire and didn't renew it.
Right.
So,
well, if you look at the culture of Fox News that Roger Ailes has built and has been supported by Rupert Murdoch, you know, it's one that you could argue objectifies women, that you know, good looks and blonde hair are a premium. And that's a little unfair because that's not completely true, but it tends to be true. And that is part of the TV producer in Roger Ailes. You know, he's a TV guy going back to the Mike Douglas show in the 1960s. And so he's about ratings. You know, he's about building a brand and serving what he sees as his you know, white, middle-aged, conservative viewership on Fox News. But that culture that he's created, you know, could support some of the things that Carlson and others are complaining about.
Well, I think some of the disparaging remarks that Roger Ailes have made about women and women anchors, and particularly blonde women anchors, go back to Paula Zahn, don't they?
They do, and you know, that was another strange case where Paula Zahn left Fox News for CNN, and Roger Ailes, you know, acting like a political operative, sort of stalked her. At least you know, like he put up a huge billboard outside CNN Center in Atlanta, you know, vilifying her for leaving Fox News, and sort of harassed her, not in a sexual way that we know of, but in a professional way. And so he's got that sort of a pattern, this background of being very, very aggressive, overly aggressive, with not only women but men too, but particularly some of the women that have worked for him in his career.
So since you've done a lot of research and written about him, do you have a clear picture on what kind of a person he is? I mean, he seems what he's done in the broader sense, and this has been a criticism I've heard a number of times about Fox News, is that in many ways Fox News has led to the polarization of politics in this country. And here we are, you know, you couldn't have a worse and more polarized time that we're living in now with issues involving race relations and gun control. And the idea, you know, I mean, first of all, there used to be a thing called the Fairness Doctrine, which was existed from the days of FDR and until Ronald Reagan got rid of it. But it had the effect of moderating political speech in the media, because simply if you were Rupert Murdoch and wanted to have your point of view thrust down the throat of the American people, you would be required under the Fairness Doctrine to offer equal and opposite equal time to an opposite point of view. And that had the effect of mediating and dampening down political speech in this country. But with the removal of the Fairness Doctrine, there's no question that Fox News came out of the gate, as did Rush Limbaugh and right-wing talk radio. So do you see that connection?
Well, those days are long gone. It's a totally different media and political era now. You know, I named my book about Roger Ailes, Dark Genius, because, you know, you have a guy here who's obviously very intelligent, he's very, very smart, very clever, and he's had a very successful career in two or three different kinds of fields, political consulting and then broadcasting. And he came along in the 90s and talked to Rupert Murdoch, and they identified a niche in the media market of conservatives who felt that they were not being served, that the media was too liberal. And so they said, we're going to create an entire network to serve this untapped media clientele out there. And you have to give them credit for their business sense, because, you know, they identified a market, they served it, they catered to it, they built it. And they continue to maintain it. But as you're saying, it hasn't done a service to our political life in that it has created a very partisan, very influential network that many feel is unfair and is not neutral in a time that our partisanship is just horrendously divisive and continues to be. You know, the good news may be, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Fox News may be moderating a bit. I don't want to hit that too hard, but there is some evidence to suggest they're not as hard right as they were, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, Dr. Cohen-Swindt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Cohen-Swindt, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns and elections and mass media. And he's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.